That was the prelude in D minor from Bach's Well-Tempered Clavier, Book 1, and it was played by Marhan Esfahani on his new album for Hyperion Records. I'm Erica Wirth and welcome to this Pianist podcast. Today I am catching up with Marhan to talk about Bach's famous 48 and much more. Marhan, we're here to talk about your new release of Book 1 of the Well-Tempered Clavier today. It's so great to have you on the show.
Really great to be with you.
Anyway, yes, thank you for joining me on this Pianist podcast. I know you've been in the throes of recording the works of Bach for over 10 years now for Hyperion Records. And at last we get book one of that well-known piece of work, The Well-Tempered Clavier. How come it's taken you so long?
Yeah, I think it's a fair question because it's funny enough, the first thing I did of the complete works of Bach was the Goldberg Variations. Which was back then for Deutsche Grammophon. But of course, now that Hyperion is part of the Universal family, you know, I don't have to do it again, which is great. And it's funny because the Goldberg Variations, which are used now as a sort of, you know, piece by debutantes to sort of announce themselves, are actually, they represent Bach in old age. Whereas the first book of the Well-Tempered Clavier, Bach is relatively young then. He was 37. When he compiled it, or when he put together the manuscript that we know as the Well-Tempered Clavier. And well, why did it take so long? Probably because, you know, when I think people listening to this podcast are going to be mostly pianists, hopefully, it's such a daunting work. You know, it's, and I think works that represent part of our formation as keyboardists, you know, the Chopin Etudes, I think, is a good example. Well-Tempered Clavier for sure. Beethoven Sonatas, you know, approaching that hopefully has some element of you know, modesty and respect for the work of hand. Doesn't always turn out to be the case, but like ideally that would be the case. And so I guess, you know, one of my harpsichord mentors who really formed who I am, a really wonderful person named Peter Watchhorn, an Australian harpsichordist who lives in the United States, for him the Well-Tempered Clavier was the way that he completely broke me down as a player and built me up again. And so, you know, I won't be lying. If Peter's listening to this, he won't mind if I say this. A lot of my work with Bach and recording Bach, particularly this, the conversation inside my head were a lot of arguments with him.
That's, you know, fascinating.
And not, you know, not necessarily negative, but just sort of, you know, my two main teachers, which were him and Zuzana Rujiskova, it was this fundamentally argumentative, discursive style of teaching where there were a lot of questions and no answers. And, you know, it's daunting when, because recording is a fundamentally anachronistic act, it's daunting when they put a microphone in front of you. And as you know, a microphone takes everything. It gives nothing back.
Yes.
And then you're supposed to put this down for posterity. Like, oh God, like I don't even take photos for posterity. Like, what am I going to, you know, like, what do I have to say about the Well-Tempered Clavier? So I would say, you know, all those things to sit down and record it, I have to forget those questions a little bit.
I guess you do. And I mean, obviously you could go back to this work in 10 years time, record it, and it'll be a completely different interpretation.
Look, this season I'm an artist in residence at the Czech Philharmonic, and I'm doing both books of the Well-Tempered Clavier. And in preparing both of them, but particularly number one, which I just recorded, I'm looking back at my decisions and I'm thinking, what the heck were you thinking? Mm-hmm. So, you know, already within a year, I'm questioning it.
Yeah, I understand that. I mean, what I like, I loved reading the accompanying notes, your booklet notes to the release.
For you.
Really great. No, they're really fantastic, Marhan. And I love how you explain that even if one plays this music in a deadpan kind of manner, one is still in a way nourished. It's like no matter how one plays it, this is genius work. This is a genius work.
Well, I mean, you know, ideally one would not play in a deadpan manner. But yes, it is genius work, but you know, how much of our view that Bach plays itself, that Bach's music plays itself, still has sort of moral probity? Like, how much of that is because of reception history of Bach? I don't know. Like, I think one of the dangers of a lot of the sort of pseudo sacred language applied to Bach's music is that people get away with doing nothing with it, and then but they've convinced the public that it's like somehow a morally good act. And I just don't really have time for that. I don't. Yeah.
That's very interesting. That's very interesting. I mean, I like your interpretation. You keep the structure. You're not too romantic, but I feel the tension in your playing. There's a certain dramatic tension.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a certain dramatic tension in the piece. I mean, first of all, I have found, honestly, Erica, over years of concerts, playing excerpts from the well-tempered clavier always falls flat. You have to play a book all as one work. They are related to one another. All the dramatic tension exists in the progression between the preludes and fugues, and the sort of narrative that unfolds over that.
You are absolutely right. You're absolutely right. I mean, and as you've mentioned, when you play the work in performance, which is quite interesting, at the end of the last number 24 in B minor, you go back and repeat the C major, number one.
I
That's
do.
very interesting. Maybe you can explain that.
Well, the fugue in B minor, I think it was Schoenberg who first pointed this out. The subject of that fugue is all 12 notes of the chromatic scale. So Bach has summed up the entire scale, such as we know it, the entire tonal scale. And so I think it asks for a resolution to C major. Of course, in an ideal world, if I were to, like, take a lot of, I don't know, creatine beforehand or something, I would then follow the B minor fugue with book two, which starts the C major again. But I don't know. I think probably, I was influenced by the fact that the Goldberg Variations has the aria again at the at, when the
Yes.
and so we've undergone a transformation. And maybe in a sense, Bach is saying, we are the aria. We are this is us. And, could it be that that happens with the first prelude? Yeah, maybe. I think that the first prelude has acquired a sort of incongruous reputation as something heavenly and innocent, when in reality, when we go through all 12 tones in the major and minor scales, we realize, like, our tonality is also quite dark. It's also quite it is of a complexity that defies easy categories. And it's funny, C major, which we think of as holy consonant, in the operas of someone like Monteverdi, early 17th century, C major represents sort of bitterness and sort of shock. And so when I come back to that prelude, I have many more complicated feelings than, oh, this is an innocent, nice prelude that, you always get someone's, like, cousin who plays it at a wedding, and you're like, no, like, it's so much more than this.
So, well, look at the Schumann Fantasy in C major. Look at that. What a work. What a all the emotions you've been through in that C major.
What a perfect analogy. Yes, I think, well, Schumann knew Bach,
No, that's amazing. But I have to say that prelude in C, isn't it amazing how it stood the test of time? I mean, it's phenomenal. And again, yes, it's in C, but there are such poignant moments in that piece, aren't there?
And it's funny because it's based essentially on the same pattern again and again, which sort of moots the need for things like melody or theme. And yet it's wholly memorable.
Yes.
And no, it is a remarkable work. I mean, Ružičková used to say that most of the preludes in the first book are just variations on the first prelude,
Wow.
which I think is true.
Goodness gracious. That's very interesting. Okay. I might be asking you a crazy question here. You'll mostly be saying
Always.
yes.
Finally.
Should all amateur pianists, piano students, study these works, the
Oh,
Folies?
certainly. Certainly. I mean, at the risk of repeating a sort of commonplace, there is something for everyone in the well-tempered clavier. Don't forget that Bach, insofar as he wrote introductions or artistic statements to his work, which was not sort of a habit in the period, he always addresses himself to lovers of music, right? He never addresses himself, he addresses himself occasionally to professionals, but he always makes sure that what he's doing should shape your tastes as a musician. And I'm always reminded by what Schweitzer wrote in his book on Bach, which was, I think he was writing about the two-part inventions, which we consider simple works, and they're really not. I find them actually quite hard to pull off. But he writes that, Schweitzer writes that anyone who's played this music will then seek it in other music. And in music that lacks these qualities, they'll find it wanting. And, I think Bach is very much blurring the line between professional and amateur. And I think, people listening to this podcast would do well, because I know a lot of your subscribers are certainly, we would describe as amateurs. The term amateur comes from loving music, right? And Erica, let's be honest, you and I both know professional musicians. How many of them love music, right? Like, some of them do, but like not everyone does. Not every, we know musicians who don't go to concerts, they don't listen to recordings. But like, I really think that, the sort of beating inner life of music depends on amateurs. And Bach took you seriously. So, next time anybody dismisses amateurs and their, and their sort of artistic goals, remember that Bach thought you were important.
That's very interesting. I mean, Bach taught these prose and fugues to his own students, didn't he?
Yes, he did. And actually, what's really funny is one of his students later wrote that Bach often got bored of teaching, which I can understand. And he would tell the students to sit down and shut up, and then Bach would just play through the well-tempered clavier.
Wow.
And one of those students said that those were like the happiest hours of his life, was listening to Bach playing the well-tempered clavier. And one can only imagine
One
what it
can
was
only
like.
imagine.
And actually, that scenario does bring up, I know I'm preempting your questions a little bit, but that does bring up, of course, the matter of variance here, which is like, did Bach for, Bach lived for 28 years after this. Did he always play Book One the exact same way for 28 years? I don't think he did. Like, he would have ornamented it, he would have had new ideas, new concepts, certainly new interpretation. And it is tantalizing to imagine, what is the sort of inner life of this music, which I find fascinating. We say, I think one thing I would encourage pianists to consider is we think that if we play the notes that are there, that we're doing justice to the music. But actually, trusting the text means that you are so immersed in the style that you know when to converse with it and when to change things. And like, Busoni, for example, we often attack Busoni and his take on Bach. Whatever you think of Busoni, Busoni's a genius and he's kind of having a conversation with a genius composer. Busoni's take was that recomposition or reimagining of the music actually is much more faithful to Bach than just playing the notes that are there. And, I think in any other field, if you were to say, trust the text to the point, to the extent that it overrides your what your ears tell you and what your musical experience tells you, in any other field, we would call that fanaticism, right? We would call that extremism. And yet we somehow accept it in music. And I don't know if I find that acceptable. Like this idea that we play the notes as they're there and we get nothing out of the relations between the notes except this sort of vague sense that we're doing something morally good. What's different from that and using total faith in a religious book to bomb people? Well, I'm sorry, but like I don't see any moral difference between these. And I would advise people to suspend the way that we put Bach on that pedestal. I think it gets us, it makes him distant from us. I think that's very, very dangerous.
I think because we so revere him. He's like this, he is like the god, isn't he? Everybody says this. So many people say he's my desert island disc composer. I might be
Sure,
one of them. I might be one
sure,
of them
sure.
because you are constantly learning with Bach. I
Of
mean,
course you are.
one bar of his music
Sure.
is unbelievable.
But the amazing thing is Bach did not consider himself the best composer of his time.
That's remarkable.
Yeah, he considered other
Isn't
people better composers. He didn't. So, is it partly modesty? Maybe. I don't see him as a person particularly given to that kind of irony. I just think that he did his work and he did it well. And now it's time for us to redefine it. It's funny that a harpsichordist should be saying that because supposedly when you play the harpsichord, you're reconstructing what Bach wanted. I'm not doing that. I'm not doing that at all.
Well, I was going to ask you, funnily enough,
Tell me.
about, you're playing on the harpsichord. I have a feeling you've also played these pieces on the piano.
When I was younger, sure.
Do you think, well, there's obviously a big difference on the modern day instrument. Do you think, I don't want to say authentic, but do you think, is it more authentic on the harpsichord?
No, not at all. Certainly
Okay.
not. And I mean, the harpsichord is simply another expressive device. Another word that we would use for that is instrument, which is the vehicle for our personal expressivity. Is it more authentic? No, and I don't even think that like that concept, if you said that to Bach, I don't even think he would understand what you meant.
Oh, yes, of course, it's all it's the music, isn't it, that matters?
Yeah, and also like he lived at a time where music is constantly changing. Like we know that earlier manuscripts of his work compared to ones prepared 30, 40 years later, there are musical changes in them because style changed. So like Bach would have been this idea that you would bring up the performance of a piece to match what the composer originally heard in the first performance, Bach would be like, "What are you talking about? Like, that sounds insane. Why would you do that?" But at the same time, I hold that Bach wrote these for the harpsichord or clavichord, possibly, because he felt that they were expressive instruments. And if you said to him, "Well, I want to play them on the piano," he'd be like, "Oh, that's great. Like, you're expressive on the piano. But like, hey, also, if somebody wants to be expressive on the harpsichord, that's totally fine." I just don't, he wouldn't have seen these binaries. I think we would have found him a really fascinating partner in that dialogue.
Yeah, it's very interesting because often we're told as students, or when you hear a criticism from a concert, you're often told the composer comes first. It comes before your own emotion, your own take on something.
I mean, what does that even mean? I feel like that's just a marketing gimmick. I don't get it. I mean, yes, the composer comes first in the sense that like he doesn't come last, right? But like, it doesn't, I feel like it's reducing music to answering questions as opposed to
Yeah,
anything.
I guess though we cannot stray away from the score too much. I guess rhythmic whatever's. I don't know. We can't maybe be play it too much with rubato, too
Oh, why not? But
romantically.
what does that even mean? Why not?
Ooh, what do you think then to the
Well,
very
first of all,
Romanian?
the notion that rubato is somehow romantic is not borne out by the facts, right? Like what we call romantic, if you listen to recordings from late romanticism, because don't forget, recording starts in the late 19th century, the romantics are actually pretty direct in the way that they play. But also, we're listening to people from the 1890s, 1880s, the pianist who was born the earliest whose recordings we have,
Yes.
I forget his, I think it's Tomei, I probably got that wrong, who had known Chopin. And we have recordings of Rachmaninoff, who had studied with Salotti, who's a student of Liszt. We have Liszt's records from his master classes. And like the style is changing every decade. So like if you want to say that there's a romantic style from about 1810 to 1910, like I don't hear it. I don't think there is a romantic style. And actually even within the romantic period, playing Bach with soul was criticized. And I think actually the distinction that we're talking about is Bach's music is often seen in traditions of pianism as being music that exists before real music. If that makes sense. So like Maybe with Mozart, definitely with Beethoven. You know, we it's expressive. It's expressivity. It's personal expressivity. But like Bach exists in some like magical fiberglass cage
Yes.
that has nothing to do with real art. And I think that's the issue that we're dealing with. And you know, I remember a classmate of mine saying when I was at university, because I didn't go to music college, so we didn't, you know, I didn't sit in a canteen with other musicians and criticize everybody, right? I do that now, but that's different. And one of these classmates, she said, like, oh, you know, Bach, like, isn't that music that like there's a lot of rules? Like it feels like there's a lot of rules to play it. And I think, first of all, it begs the question, does other music not have rules? But also, you know, why particularly this? Why have we convinced ourselves that there's something that we have to turn off in order to do justice to this music? That seems like a very poor reflection on Bach. It seems a very poor reflection on us. And it makes me very sad. I just as a last anecdote, I remember teaching briefly for one of these American summer courses, which I won't say which one, and there was some very powerful pianists on the faculty, and I taught a class on Bach. And I had, you know, people in their sort of early 20s, really, really solid players, very fine players from American conservatoires, all pianists. And only afterwards I found out from the person who ran the whole thing was that these were students who, by the time they were 22, they were considered too old and failures, and they weren't that great, so we'll just leave them to play Bach. And I thought, what does that say about what you think about all of, like, all, you know, in the words of Gordon Ramsay, like, why are we doing this to each other? Like, what does that say about what you think about what we're doing? Yeah, I find that very sad. After you stop recording, I'll tell you who that was, but I won't tell you now.
Oh, yeah, I know. Well, I do find
Exactly.
that
In my
sad.
own situation, I often hear about students or people saying, oh, my piano teacher wants me to learn a Bach Prelude and Fugue, as if it's almost a negative thing. There's that whole thing about Bach being, I don't know, not difficult, but just, oh, Bach. Forbidding, I think, is the term. And I think, just to share a sort of example. So, like, you know, Bach, I feel, comes naturally to me. Something that, you know, growing up didn't come naturally to me was like I was not very athletic, right? And like now I am, like, I go to a gym a lot and I'm very active and I play sports and stuff. And what made me serious about being athletic was that I found people who said to me, like, this improves your life, like, this is a good, you have it within you to like engage with this, and this is good for you, and as opposed to like you'll never be able to do this. And I think if the a priori way that we look at Bach is like this is above you, right, it's this whole thing of like Bach is God, right, so you'll never get there, that's so unhelpful. Like every time I see, you know, these clever quotes from people where they're like, I don't have a God, Bach is my God. It's like, that is stupid, right? Like if you ask Bach, he would have thought that that was insane. I mean, he would have considered it blasphemous amongst other things, but also he would have been like, what are you talking about? Like, and I think it's this, we confuse art, this like thing in quotation marks, with being an artisan. And I think Bach would have seen himself as an artisan. He would have seen himself as a craftsman. And I
Yes.
think once you see it in that light, you know, playing his music is as much a dialogue with him. And no doubt he is a great figure, but it's as much of a dialogue with everything that makes us human as much as it is playing a Rachmaninoff prelude, or as much as it is playing, you know, a Chopin nocturne, or it is playing, you know, God forbid, Schumann Humoresque, which is so long. I don't know if I want to deal with that. But like, do you know what I mean? And I think that's, I would like to see that change. If I may go on the record and say, I find it unfortunate that there is a trend in pianism, unfortunately not gone yet, which reduces Bach to sort of middle class pleasantries. You know, to sort of, you know, would you like another biscuit and another cup of tea? Sort of, and I just like, I'm tired of this. Either that, or it's this sort of like, well, I, as the Bach interpreter, I had a chat with God earlier today, and he told me this, And now I'm sharing it with you. And it always reminds me of, there's this great line from Don Rickles, who's a comedian, a great Jewish comedian whom I love very much. And it was on some one of these Vegas roasts or something. And he says, "Oh, you know, I came back from the dead and I was in heaven." And the serious guy says, "Oh, what is heaven like? Tell us, tell us." And he says, "You know, everybody says heaven's up there, but actually it's a little more to the left."
Okay,
Yeah.
fair enough. Very funny. Oh, Mahan, you've got so absorbed in Bach. I kind of now want to turn to another composer. A
Oh, yeah.
bit of lightweight talk, maybe. But no. And your upcoming little stint at the Wigmore Hall.
Yes.
You're doing a series there. How lovely. Two recitals, called A Scarlet
Three.
Focus. Three. Okay. I have two. One in October, one in January. Is there one on?
Yeah. And then there's one later in the spring, but I forget the date. I'm so bad at remembering dates. You know
Don't
what I do?
worry.
I learn the rep and then I just look at my calendar and I was like, oh, you have to play X, Y, and Z. Great. That's what I do. I have no idea of dates.
Oh, well, it's great. I mean, Scarlatti, I love Scarlatti.
Me too.
And I'm so glad you're going to be giving those three recitals. How come Scarlatti now?
Well, I mean, I've always been fascinated by Scarlatti. Also, the truth is, he wrote almost 600 sonatas, so better get a head start now. I mean, I have like 200 of his sonatas in my rep already. I mean, for years I've been playing a lot of Scarlatti, and I thought, well, okay, you got one third of the way through, may as well do the other two thirds. But on a more serious level, I think, you know, there's this quote from Mahler, which I find a little bit pretentious, but Mahler says, you know, a symphony must be the whole world. It must represent everything. And I think Scarlatti represents everything. He does interact with the whole world. He interacts very much with people's music, if that makes sense. Sort of, you know, music of the street, music of, you know, sort of folk music, you know, obviously music of the church, music of the theater. What I love about Scarlatti is that there is no approach to learning his sonatas. Every sonata has its own approach, which
Okay.
is incredibly stressful, but also just exhilarating. You know, and Scarlatti is amazing. And I have to say, without getting too much into depth, because you know, I've been reading a lot about him, the sources of Scarlatti suggest that at least 400 of his sonatas, of the approximately 600, were written in the last 5 years of his life.
Right, okay.
And it's like, what was he doing?
Yeah.
I just find him truly tremendous.
Are you doing the sonata? So it's the sonatas that you'll be playing in those three recitals. Are you taking us on a journey?
Yeah, fair question. So the first one will be only Scarlatti. The second one, I'm looking at Scarlatti within the context of the Spanish Enlightenment, which I think is something that in the Anglophone world we don't discuss enough. Spain actually is a country that goes very much intellectually in the throes of Enlightenment. It's not a sort of closed, backwards country. So Scarlatti influences composers around him. But also, people forget the only composer other than Scarlatti who's disseminated in the second half of the 18th century in Spain is Haydn. There's a ton of Haydn in Spain. So I'll be playing a Haydn sonata also in that second program in January. And then the third one, I don't know yet because I haven't finished the program. So we'll see. We'll see. But you know, potentially Scarlatti's you know, dialogue with, you know, Handel or potentially Bach could be a theme. But I have to get around to that. So
That sounds great. I'll be there. I'll be there on the when's the first one? A end of September.
October 15th.
Oh yeah. Okay, we've got plenty of time.
You tell me about it.
Okay.
I have plenty of time. Yeah.
I'll put that in the diary. Okay, so Mahan, I think we're gonna have to get onto some little light-hearted questions for you. Okay, and it's like if you were questions, and I'm asking them to you off the cuff, and you just come back to
Go
me.
crazy.
Okay, here we go. First question. If you could play only one composer from now on, who would it be?
Scarlatti.
I thought you. Really?
I think so.
I was so sure you'd say Bach.
Oh, what if I could listen to one composer for the rest of my life? It's Bach. That's it.
Oh, okay. That's so interesting. So, okay, I'm gonna stop it there. I won't. Scarlatti. Okay, so you find him so interesting to play and play and yeah. Okay. Next question. And because you're a harpsichordist, I'm gonna have to ask you slightly differently. One harpsichordist or pianist, dead or alive, you travel long and far to hear.
The Wigmore series, which starts on October 15th, that is to the day, 70 years after the harpsichordist Ralph Kirkpatrick presented three recitals of Scarlatti at Wigmore Hall. And it wasn't planned that way, it just kind of happened. And Kirkpatrick's always been a big idol of mine. He also played a lot of new music. He commissioned like Elliot Carter and people like that. And I think I really would have liked to have heard him.
How interesting.
Yeah.
Oh, it's lovely. Okay, wonderful. One person, dead or alive, you'd love to play for.
Nikolaeva,
Oh,
the
okay.
pianist, because she's been a big inspiration on me, especially her Bach playing. But in general, I mean, her Shostakovich, everything she did. Yeah, I just find her really interesting. I envy anybody who got to meet her. I think she's just such a fascinating person.
And if you could summarize her type of Bach playing.
Alive. There's this sort of beating heart of her music, and controversial, helpfully, which I love.
Okay, I like that. Do you have any technical struggles?
Oh, sure. My fifth finger on each hand is just notably shorter than the other fingers, and it means that I have to think about fingering a lot. To amateurs listening to this who think that like their hands don't work, the truth is you just have to find the fingerings that work for you. Any of my friends who've seen my scores will see that they're covered in fingerings. I sometimes write two sets of fingerings for everything. And I also write fingerings for ornaments.
Yes. Oh, yes, I think that's a good idea. And I mean, funnily enough, my next question, most probably you've already answered it. What would be your advice to amateur keyboard players as to how to improve?
Decide what you're trying to achieve at that session at the piano.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Right? Like have a goal. Right? The idea isn't to play a piece through, right? The concert, you can do that in the concert. The idea isn't to play it through, it isn't to play that tempo. But like if you decide today, I'm really gonna fix the trills and like these four bars, these six bars, I'm going to like get my pinky to work and whatever technical issue. Make it an achievable goal. And like, guess what? Then you don't have to work like 3 hours stressing yourself out about playing something at tempo. You spent 45 minutes on this technical problem. Good for you. Like you've done. And I think my advice is, I remember when I was at university, they said that your dissertation, the way that you finish it, is do something every day. Like even if it's like you put in a footnote, like you cross-reference something, you fix the spelling on whatever. Just do like have that achievable goal. And I know you asked for one thing, but I'll say two.
No, I think it's good,
The
yeah.
best professionals all write in their fingerings.
I love
How it
that.
is. And there are people who dispute that, especially in master classes, and it's like, okay, good luck. Like good luck with your system, because obviously it's not working. So like just write in your fingerings, man.
I love it. Yeah, that's really good. If you weren't a harpsichordist, what would you be?
I really would have dreamt of being like an interpreter to politicians. I would have loved that. So like I would have done like statecraft. I was very interested in foreign affairs. I still am.
Okay.
I read a lot about it. And I would have loved to like, I kind of regret I didn't do, Russian and Chinese and stuff at university. And then I could have traveled the world with, whoever and been their interpreter. And like, yeah, I've always found that world, that sort of, Henry Kissinger sort of world, very fascinating.
Yeah.
And I think I would have made a fun, maybe less fat Kissinger. Like I would have enjoyed being someone like him. Maybe not as
Oh.
evil, but
You speak a lot of languages anyway, don't you? I'm sure. I have a feeling.
Yeah, but like I can't. I'm not gonna translate for like Chairman Mao or something, am I? I'm not gonna. I speak languages to communicate, but I think people who are interpreters on that, on with that level of
Yes.
being gifted, are I really admire them. I think that would be
Of
really cool
course.
too. Yeah.
Of course. Last question. One composer you're not ready to tackle.
Oh, okay, that's a fair point. Just because I think his music represents the distillation of life experience. I think I'm too young to really do justice to Couperin.
Whoa.
Yeah, I think I'm just not there yet. I think Couperin is like, it's like late Brahms. He's distilling, a sort of life observed.
Goodness.
Yeah.
Couperin. So you haven't played any Couperin, or you've
No,
tried
I
to?
have. I play them in recitals, but the younger stuff, the more theatrical stuff, the really like inner life stuff of Couperin, which is most of, I always compare it to, Brahms Opus 118, 119, stuff like that, Brahms Caprichos. There's this reflection on the frailty of life. And I just don't feel that frail yet. So,
Oh,
it
it
requires,
sounds.
I think it's you have to be very vulnerable. Yeah.
Sokolov plays a lot of Couperin, doesn't he?
He does, but again, he plays the sort of toy Couperin.
Okay.
And I think that
The
appeals to
popular.
everyone. But I think
Yes.
the really like inner Couperin that sort of defies human emotions, easily categorized human emotions, I think awaits us.
Oh, okay. That sounds interesting. I must go and check out some of that. Couperin.
Yeah, super stuff.
Okay. Well, I'd have loved to have asked you more. My goodness, I didn't
Okay,
even.
you asked plenty.
I was going to ask you about your the harpsichord on which you recorded, but I could ask
Oh,
you.
why not? Well,
Why
look,
not? A few more
it's a
minutes.
very special harpsichord that was built by a friend of mine, Hugh Saunders. I'm very honored to say he's a friend of mine. He's a great builder in London. And
Okay.
it's a copy of a 1710 instrument, which was said to have come from the estate of Wilhelm Friedemann Bach, who is J.S. Bach's eldest son. And we, th you know, did he receive it from his father? It's not clear. But, it certainly comes from that Bach circle.
Okay, great. And you have you recorded on it before?
Yes, I did my Goldberg Variations on it.
Oh, fantastic. So it's
Yeah,
afraid.
but it was restrung before the well-tempered clavier, so I think it sounds very different now.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And finally, I forgot to ask you. You've got a lecture at the Victoria and Albert
Yes,
Museum on the 28th.
talking about well-tempered clavier.
Yeah,
Yes.
exactly, on the 28th of September, V&A Museum in London. Will you be exploring the well-tempered clavier on different keyboards?
No, I'll actually be looking at sort of its direct predecessors and like the sort of distinction between prelude and fugue and what's the sort of aesthetic underpinnings of prelude and fugue. What is Bach's sort of innovation at the keyboard? Because we don't think of Bach as an innovative composer, but he is a deeply innovative composer.
Yes.
And sort of provoking that discussion.
Interesting. I look forward to that. Maybe some listeners out there will come along. 28th of September, we said, right? Yes.
Yes.
Okay, I'll be there. Mahan, it's
Lovely
been
to
a
talk to
pleasure,
you.
really
Lovely
a
to talk
pleasure.
to you.
I could have talked to you for ages. But thank you so much for joining us on this pianist podcast. I'm
Thank
sure
you.
people have heard an awful lot. Thank you again.
Thanks very much.
That was the opening of the Prelude in G major from Bach's Well-Tempered Clavier Book One, and it was played by Marhan Esfahani on his new album for Hyperion Records. Pianist podcasts are free, and a really good way to support what we do is by subscribing to Pianist. Visit our website at pianistmagazine.com and listen to us on YouTube by searching Pianist Magazine. And don't forget to sign up to our newsletter, which is full of extra playing tips and useful information. Go to pianistmagazine.com to find out how to sign up.